Sorry I was a few minutes late tonight. I managed to leave my notes and my Bible here this morning, and I didn't realise that I did. So there was a panicked search of the house earlier as sort of all five of us set in you know, a big Bible hunt and a big notes hunt, and in the end I decided that goodness knows where they were and so on and all that held me up a bit. So apologies for that. But now, if you remember this morning, then we thought about how God wants there to be springs of living water flowing out of us into the communities that we live in, and that's sort of one of the ideas that Jesus was putting over in what he said to the woman, to the Samaritan woman in John chapter 4. And I kind of gave you the idea of saying, well, but you know, our wells can be, our springs can become polluted. And I sort of reminded you of the sort of polluted mud pots that you get in Yellowstone National Park, where there's sort of nothing can grow out of them, because although there's water coming out, then it's of no use at all. And we're going to think in a way of we're going to think a bit more about that idea of how we can harm our testimony as Christians. And I'll start off just with something which was brought to mind. I was on a training course a couple of years back now, and we had to stay in the Miskin Manor in Miskin, you know, so near, not far from Llantrisant, and it was a residential course. I had to stay overnight, and just on the wall opposite, the room that I was staying in was a fairly unusual sort of picture. Normally, you're kind of in hotels and so on. You have pictures on the wall, but this one instead was some text, and as you kind of walked from one side to the other, you got to see different bits of it. And what it said was were these words. It said, "Act justly, love mercy, and walk humbly," which is quite an unusual thing to sort of have on the wall in a hotel. And of course, for those of you who are familiar with it, that's actually a passage from the book of Micah. And somebody at some point, I take it, thought, well, that's probably quite a good thing to implant in the minds of business people who are going to this hotel. You know, act justly, love mercy, walk humbly. And that's Micah chapter 6, verse 8. What does the Lord require of you but to act justly, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God? And that single verse from Micah underpins so much of the Christian teaching that Jesus gives, for example. You know, it sets some principles that a lot of the stuff was built on. So we're just going to keep that verse in mind, but actually pick up the story in a few moments, but we won't turn to it yet. We're going to pick up the story from Nehemiah. And Nehemiah was a man who, he was one of the Jews who'd been exiled into Babylon. And some Jews had gone back and they were trying to rebuild Jerusalem. And things weren't going terribly well, and Nehemiah got to hear about it. And he asked for permission. He was a very high, very senior official in the king's court, in the Assyrian king's court. And he asked for permission to go back to help with the rebuilding effort. And when Nehemiah sort of turned up, then suddenly everything was energized, you know, and he got stuff to happen, you know. He was a great bloke for making things happen. And so the city had no defenses. The walls were crumbling down. So Nehemiah got the walls rebuilt. And there were no city gates, and he got some gates erected, and there was a lack of leadership, and he provided leadership. There was opposition. People were mocking them and saying it'll never work, and so on. Sanballat the Hittite and all these other great characters who were opposed to Nehemiah's work, and he overcame them all. And progress was being made. And then, just like so often happens, you know, and this is just the way it is, you know, this is human nature and everything. We find it in churches as well. Just as progress was being made against dealing with all these outside problems, you know, get your defences sorted, deal with the opposition, then problems came from within. And there's an interesting particular problem that we come across. And it's interesting for me because, you know, I hesitate to say this because I might kind of get sort of booed from the front and sent given a spanking and sent home, but I'm actually a banker. Well, I'm not quite a banker, so perhaps I'm not that bad, because the company I work for is owned by a building society rather than by a bank, so perhaps we're a little bit nicer than banks. But it's an interesting topic for a banker. And you know, we before we turn to it, I just want to give you a bit of background about where we are in Britain at the moment, okay? Spoken as somebody who works in the industry. Because, you know, we've read recently, haven't we, that the economy seems to be coming out of recession and so on, but we're still in a bit of a hole, and Britain is still poorer than it was, or we thought we were, back in 2008 when the problems all began. And I'll just tell you a little bit about where it all began, and we'll see what Nehemiah has got to say about the economic crisis in Britain. You didn't think that a book that was written 2,500 years ago had much to say about the economy of 21st century Britain, did you? But it does. It's extraordinary. So anyway, it all began in America. And there were these things called ninja loans in America. Now, a ninja loan stands for, it's nothing to do with Ninja Turtles, it's nothing to do with, you know, Japanese sort of characters or whatever. A ninja loan was a loan made to somebody who had no income, no job, and no assets. Okay, no income, no job, no assets. Ninja. Okay, that's what the acronym stands for. So how on earth could somebody who's got no income, no job, and no assets possibly borrow money? And, well, you know, but there are plenty of people like that. No income, no jobs, no assets. If you can find a way of lending them money and making money out of it, you've got a whole new market. And some of the American banks worked out how to do it. And the American housing market had just been going up in value for decades. You know, we've had housing crises in Britain, but America's never really had it on a national level, and the house prices always went up. So the cunning plan they hatched was this. You lend somebody some money, and you give them a teaser rate, which is really cheap, okay? So you charge them a very low rate of interest for a while, and you say that when you've had your loan for 3 years or 4 years or something like that, we'll put the interest rate up. Now, they might not be able to afford that interest rate in 3 or 4 years' time. In fact, it's quite likely they wouldn't. You know, I was looking at one example to see how some of this stuff worked. And so a $1,500 interest repayment in certain circumstances might rise to $6,000 a month afterwards. So, you know, so somebody who might say, well, hey, you know, $1,500 a month, that's less than the rent I'm paying. I'll take out a mortgage instead. Then in 3 or 4 years' time, suddenly finds themselves presented with a monthly bill for $6,000. They haven't got a chance, have they? So what good is that to the bank, you say? They're not going to get this $6,000. Well, at that point, they foreclose, the American term for repossession. So they grab the property back, and because house prices always go up, then there's plenty of profit in there. And because they've repossessed it, and they've put loads of fees on, and arrears interest, and all this kind of stuff, and they've made a killing. Great, it works really well. You know, for a long time, people were making a killing on these ninja loans. Loads and loads and loads of money. Unaffordable loans and a profit model that was based on taking houses away from families. Completely legal, and for a while, very, very profitable, for as long as house prices rise. And, you know, but it's not just the, that's not the only kind of unaffordable loans. We've had other unaffordable loans, haven't we, you know? So people lending money to countries like Greece or Italy or Portugal, when if you sit down and do the maths, you'll work out they've never got any chance of repaying it in the long run, but as long as you think that you'll get your money back and the person who lends them after you is going to be the one with the problem, then you make money. And it doesn't matter whether the next generation of Greeks or Italian children are left with debts and no hope of any kind of sort of job or future, that's somebody else's problem, not yours. Making money out of somebody's misery. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, of course, when all this has come crashing down because house prices stopped rising and somebody suddenly realised that the Greeks and the Italians and the Portuguese haven't got enough money to repay, then there's a bit of a problem because, as the economist John Maynard Keynes once said, if you owe your bank £100, you've got a problem. But if you owe your bank £1,000,000, the bank's got a problem. And that's the way it works, you know? So lots of banks owed lots of money that they couldn't afford to reap. And the slump was dramatic. In San Francisco, in one area of San Francisco, the average price of a house went from $450,000 down to $110,000. That's a quarter of the price, less than a quarter of the price. And the banks lost money. And it was impossible for the debtors to repay. Huge losses for the banks. And the losses spread around the system. And the banks kind of, you know, run out of money or go bust, and so they stop lending because they haven't got any capital to lend, and they're worried about house prices going down any further, and then because the banks aren't lending any money, then nobody's got any money to go and spend in the shops, and, you know, and so on and so on. I'm not here particularly to give you a lesson in economics and the recession. So, what on earth has this got to do with Nehemiah, which we'll get to in a moment, and the Bible? Well, we're far more likely in 21st century Britain to ask when somebody lends money to someone. We're far more likely, and certainly 10 years ago, we were far more likely to ask the question, is it legal? Or is it something that the regulator allows to happen? Than to ask the question, is it moral? Because asking questions about morality is awkward and a bit embarrassing, and that's perhaps something that people talk about in churches, maybe, but possibly not. And so, somehow or other, legality became a substitute for morality. And so these American banks, people said, well, they're not doing anything wrong. They're not breaking any laws. People want to borrow money. Why do we care about the morality of all this? And, you know, we'll find out in a moment that not all lending is moral in God's eyes. And when you step back and say, well, what would somebody like Micah have to say about some of this stuff? What was it he said? Micah, act justly, love mercy, and walk humbly. What about, well, act justly. Is deceiving people about how much the mortgage is going to cost acting justly? Is exploiting the poor and the powerless and the ignorant in order to make lots of money out of them at the same time as causing them misery, is that acting justly? It doesn't sound like it to me, on the face of it. Maybe you might try to build the case. On the face of it, it doesn't sound like it. What about a business model which is based on taking homes away from families, where you know that your only chance of making money is to repossess loans? Or repossess houses. I once did some work for a company that I'm glad to say has long since gone out of business, and I never want to do any work with them again. And this was some consultancy work for the business I worked with, which worked on a basis of a 50% repossession rate. They knew that they were going to repossess off more than 50% of the people they lent money to. How does something like that work with Micah's command to love mercy? When you set off saying, I'm going to get this back and make some money out of it, that doesn't sound very merciful, does it? What about encouraging people who say, here, you might not have much money, but I can lend you the money to have a lifestyle, to have the car and the jewelry and the clothes or the holidays or whatever it is that you want, even though you can't afford it. That encouraging lifestyles of greed rather than humility, how does that stand with walking humbly before your God? Amazing, isn't it? Micah was spot on. He understood some of these problems. Acting justly, loving mercy, walking humbly. And I think that you can probably build a pretty strong case just from looking at Micah before we get any further to say that much of the lending that was going on, particularly in America, but also to an extent in this country before the financial crisis, might have been legal, but certainly failed the test of morality as far as God was concerned. So, that's a fairly long introduction to Nehemiah. We will get to Nehemiah, and we'll get there now. And let's have a look at Nehemiah chapter 5, I think. Yeah, chapter 5, you've got the right one. Nehemiah chapter 5, and we're going to read the first five verses initially, and we'll see how we get on. So Nehemiah 5, verse 1 says this, "Now the men and their wives raised a great outcry against their Jewish brothers." So this is now based back in Jerusalem. These are the people who are rebuilding Jerusalem together. They raised a great outcry against the Jewish brothers. Some were saying, "We and our sons and daughters are numerous. In order for us to eat and stay alive, we must get grain." We've got to eat. That's kind of straightforward, isn't it? Others were saying, "We're mortgaging our fields and our vineyards and our homes to get grain during the famine." And still others were saying, "We've had to borrow money to pay the king's tax on our fields and vineyards. And although we are of the same flesh and blood as our countrymen, and though our sons are as good as theirs, yet we have to subject our sons and daughters to slavery. Some of our daughters have already been enslaved, but we're powerless because our fields and our vineyards belong to others." So, what's going on here? Sometime after Nehemiah had got back and they were rebuilding Jerusalem, they found that there was a famine. And you know, the economy was in a bad state. They'd had to spend a lot of money on defence, right? They'd been rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. It had taken a lot of cash. It had been hard for them to raise the revenues for that. And they'd invest a lot of time, which they might otherwise have been spending growing spare crops to tide them over a difficult year. And so there was famine. And, of course, they'd still had to pay taxes to Assyria. And so the taxes were high, the crop was poor, they spent a lot of money on defence. And that, just like you'll find wherever you are in the world, one person's misery is almost always somebody else's profit opportunity. And a whole bunch of people were hungry, and other people saw the chance to make some money. And so what they did is they took the chance to lend to people who couldn't repay. Sounds a bit like the American subprime mortgage crisis to me. They lent money to people who could repay, and actually their interest rates might have been a little bit better than some of the American ones. 17.9% APR. You know, I'm a mathematician. I can do the maths, and we find out later what the interest rate was charged. So in our terms, it would have been a 17.9% APR sort of mortgage rate. And they lent money to people who couldn't repay. And why did they do it? The usual reason why mortgage lenders will lend money to someone who can't afford to repay is because they actually want to get the assets that the person's got. And so when people couldn't afford to repay the interest, they went and they got the vineyards and the fields and the houses. And so the people who had some money now had a lot of money. And the people who were hungry now found they were hungry and they had no property. And so it was cheap farms and cheap slaves for a few rich people. And was it legal? Yes, it was legal. It wasn't breaking any Assyrian law. Assyrian law was what applied here. They hadn't broken the law. Was it moral? It was an outrage. And so the farmers were losing their livelihoods, and the women and children were being enslaved. And you know, it's easy for us, because people around us tend to very often equate legality and morality. If something's legal, I can do it. It's easy for us to slip into the same way of thinking. And particularly when you're in at work, when you're in a business environment, and, you know, well, we're allowed to do it. Why shouldn't we? And the fact that you're allowed to do something doesn't mean to say that you ought to do it. You know, there are many things that, if I told you that I did for a living, that you'd be outraged. If I said that I ran a chain of strip clubs, then you wouldn't be very impressed. And you would almost certainly not invite me back here again. But if I told you that, you know, I make money by lending money to people, some of them, you know, and I kind of you put some fine words around it, but really what I'm saying is I lend money to people who can't afford to repay, and I make my living by taking their homes back from them, then you might not quite notice the problem with what I'm doing and welcome me back. But actually, they're both as bad as each other. The fact that you're allowed to do something doesn't mean to say that you can do it. And you should be just as disgusted if you found out that I was trying to teach you God's word at the same time as exploiting the poor, as you would if you found that I was doing other things that you might think as being morally dubious. But where does that leave us? You know, where does that leave us as consumers, for example? You know, this is not just what we do in work, but every time I spend my money. Am I, in spending my money, exploiting the poor? Am I harming people in what I'm doing? These things are complicated, and they're not straightforward, and it's not always obvious what the right way of spending our money is. And I'm not pretending, but we should consider these things. Am I party to exploiting people who were like these people in Nehemiah's day? Where is the money that I have in a pension fund, if I have one? Where is it invested? Do I care? Is it harming people or helping them? So Nehemiah hears about what's going on, and in verse 6 we find out his reaction. He says this: "When I heard their outcry and these charges, I was very angry." Nehemiah didn't see this as being a grey area. He saw it as a black and white area. What these people were doing was disgraceful. Now, the problem here was not that they were charging too much interest. The problem was that they were charging interest at all. Because under Jewish law, then Jews weren't allowed to charge interest to each other. This was said very clearly by Moses in Exodus, and it's in Exodus chapter 22, verse 25. It tells you this: if you lend money to one of my people among you who's needy, don't be like a money lender. Charge him no interest. If you take your neighbor's cloak as a pledge, return it to him by sunset, because his cloak is the only covering he has for his body. What else will he sleep in? When he cries out to me, I'll hear, for I'm compassionate. So, in Israel, money lenders weren't allowed to charge interest. Lending money to someone was something you did to help them, not to make a profit out of them. And also, if you took security, you had to be sensitive. You weren't to take somebody. If you took somebody's coat as security, then you had to hand it back, even if they couldn't afford to give you the loan back, because they needed the coat to stay warm. And you find other rules. You find there was a year of jubilee, which came up every so often, when all debts would be cancelled and slaves would be set free. Now, commentators have talked about how this was taken, and the consensus is that the Jews were allowed to lend money if they were lending outside the Jewish community. The consensus is that they were probably allowed if they were lending money to each other for business purposes. But this was something which was just specific to the Jews, but that they were not to take advantage of their fellow brothers and sisters who were someone in need. A person in need is not a profit opportunity. And Nehemiah is outraged because there's hypocrisy going on here. Because, you know, all of these Jews had been taken into captivity in Babylon and essentially enslaved by the Babylonians when they'd been victorious in battle over the Jews. They'd been taken away to Babylon, and now the Babylonians had lost a battle to the Assyrians, and the Assyrians were the ruling power, and the new Assyrian king would come in and said, well, look, you Jews, I'll allow many of you to go back to Jerusalem, to the land of your forefathers. I'll allow you to go back. They've been given their freedom. So they were people who'd been enslaved and been given their freedom, and for people who'd received their freedom from a Gentile king to then be enslaving fellow Jews was an outrage. You know, how can, you know, Nehemiah saying, how can you possibly be behaving worse than a Gentile king? You're supposed to be Jews. You're supposed to know God. This is disgraceful. And so Nehemiah was angry. And it's interesting, isn't it? A couple of things about his anger. Firstly, it wasn't selfish. You know, he wasn't angry because he was being hurt. He was angry on behalf of the poor and the oppressed. But also, he took his time to think about it. In verse 7, we read that he wasn't hasty. He pondered things in his mind before jumping to a conclusion. He knew that these things were not necessarily clear-cut or simple and so on. You had to reflect on them. And having reflected on them, his answer was that he was angry. So, Nehemiah's angry. The people are being enslaved by moneylenders who are looking to exploit their misery as a way of gaining land and make money. What happens? Let's carry on reading in verse 6. When I heard their outcry and these charges, I was very angry. I pondered them in my mind, and I accused the nobles and officials. I told them, you're exacting usury from your own countrymen. So I called together a large meeting to deal with them, and I said, as far as possible, we have bought back our Jewish brothers who were sold to the Gentiles. Now you are selling your brothers only for them to be sold back to us. And they kept quiet because they couldn't find anything to say. So I continued, what you are doing is not right. Shouldn't you walk in the fear of God to avoid the reproach of our Gentile enemies? I and my brothers and my men are also lending the people money and grain, but let the exacting of usury stop. Give back to them immediately their fields and vineyards and olive groves and houses, and also the usury you're charging them, the hundredth part of the money, grain, and new wine and oil. So, Nehemiah's solution. It was that any property that had been taken as security and repossessed by the money lenders was to be returned to the people who pledged it as security in the first place. And those people who had money and who had grain were to continue lending it, but they weren't to charge interest. And Nehemiah's solution was hugely expensive for the creditors. These people who were looking to make money now found they were going to be losing it. But they agree. Amazingly, the creditors agree. So why did they agree so easily? Well, they agreed in part because they could see that Nehemiah had moral authority. He'd behaved properly throughout. And it would have been hard for him to teach the truth to people if he'd behaved improperly somewhere along the line. You know, and this is what I was saying about, you know, we as Christians can, that spring of living water that we talked about this morning coming out of us can get polluted. And then what good are we, how are we able to give the hope of Jesus to people if they can point at us and say, but look at your life. But Nehemiah had that moral authority. And the people had three problems. They had famine, and they had money lenders and taxes. And if you kind of think about these, well, the famine was outside Nehemiah's control. But they had trouble with the money lenders. But Nehemiah had been lending money, and he'd shown that it was possible to lend it, and he hadn't been taking security, and he hadn't been charging interest. And they had trouble with taxes. Well, you know, the taxes to the king of Assyria might have been outside Nehemiah's control. But Nehemiah actually had been doing everything he could to keep the taxes light. We read down a little bit further. Well, let me read it to you. It says this. Nehemiah is talking about his own testimony. He says, moreover, from the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, the Assyrian king, that is, when I was appointed to be governor in the land of Judah, until his 32nd year, that's 12 years, neither I nor my brothers ate the food allotted to the governor. But the earlier governors, those preceding me, placed a heavy burden on the people and took 40 shekels of silver from them in addition to food and wine. Their assistants also lorded it over the people. But out of reverence for God, I didn't act like that. Instead, I devoted myself to the work on this wall, and all my men were assembled there for the work, and we did not acquire any land. And furthermore, 150 Jews and officials ate at my table, as well as those who came to us from the surrounding nations. And each day, one ox and six choice sheep and some poultry were prepared for me. And every 10 days, an abundant supply of wine of all kinds. And in spite of all this, I never demanded the food allotted to the governor, because the demands were heavy on the people. So Nehemiah says this, look, you know, I knew that this was a heavy burden on you to help rebuild the walls. So I didn't, you know, I was entitled as governor to draw a salary. I didn't bother, right? Because that meant that the taxes could be lower. And, you know, I had a big household to feed, all my servants and everything. And I never asked for any food from you, the people, although I was entitled to, although you should have been feeding my household and my servants. I met it all out of my own funds. Because, you know, because I was fortunate I had it. And I could see that the burden would have been heavy for you. I wasn't interested in profiting from taking taxes off people who couldn't easily afford to pay it. So Nehemiah had moral authority. And his moral authority had come out of reverence for God. That was the source of it. He was concerned to make sure that he did what was right in God's eyes. And, you know, it's terribly easy for the church and for Christians to lose that moral authority that we should have. People should be able to look at us in our personal lives, in our work lives, in whatever we do, and be able to understand that we're blameless in the way that Nehemiah is. And the question is, are we or aren't we? You know, at a high level, at a kind of like national level, it's easy for the church to lose its moral authority. Look at the damage that's been done to the Catholic Church by some priests who've misbehaved with children and others who tried to cover it up. Look at the damage that's been done to the church in Northern Ireland by years of people who, in the name of God, shot each other and blew each other up. Look at the damage that's been done to evangelicals by a few sort of, and this is maybe going back some time, TV evangelists who've been more interested in feathering their own lifestyles or caught misbehaving with women who are not their wives and living a great lifestyle when they're pretending that they're doing it for God. It's easy for the church to lose its moral authority. And it's easy for us in our own lives to lose our moral authority if we dally with sin. And so in our lives, and not just when we're in church, but when we're in work, when we're in business, when we're buying in the supermarket, deciding what to buy, when we're selling things, when we've got a ballot paper in our hands, whatever it is, then we need always to go back and ask ourselves the question, does it pass the MICA test? It's easy to remember, isn't it? The MICA test. As you do it, as you decide what you should do, ask yourself the question, am I acting justly? Am I loving mercy? Am I walking humbly with my God? That's the way that God wants us to live our lives. And I suppose the question for me, the question for all of us, is what would we do differently this week to help maintain our moral authority and the moral authority of this church?